You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. It's time to look in the mirror, America. Do you like what you see?
I keep referring to Obama as the magic Negro.
Do you like what you see now?
Well, suck on this.
It's just a mirror, America.
Shared sacrifice by everybody.
What could it do to you except reflect your image?
I did nothing wrong at the Minneapolis airport.
The Majority Report.
Far more credible to me than PBS.
And Frontline.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Tuesday, May 24th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Gala Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, we'll be welcoming to the show Dennis Vangelsdorp, the acting state apiarist. I'm not saying that properly. The bee guy from Pennsylvania. Give us an update on the status of bees in this country. Very important. Something like 80% of our food is in some way made possible by bees, I think. I got to double check on that. I'll ask the bee guy. Also on the program today, we will be talking about what's happening with the SEC. Very interesting. Had a story I was going to read it yesterday. Didn't get to it. Another story to follow up on it today. Very interesting as we start to investigate. I watched half of, what was it last night? Too Big to Fail. Fell asleep. I was too tired. And frankly, it was a little bit nauseating. Seeing, there was something, I'll talk about it in the post show. Because I want to get to this, folks, and this is an update. It appears that the 21st was not a judgment day. You could see it was just a spiritual, invisible judgment day. And so the die is cast, folks. There won't be earthquakes and hurricanes, although apparently a massive, horrible tornado. Just the other day. But all this is taking place. You're being spiritually judged. And then in October, according to the Harold Camping, October, let me get this down. October 21st, does it really matter what day it is? October 21st will be the day that hellfire and it's, you know, end of the world. So the offer still stands, 220% return on your membership fees if we are apocalypticized, as it were. And, in fact, that will start from now. So over the next 6 months or whatever it is till October, knock on wood, the show will still be in existence. You will be have your money refunded. In fact, if the show doesn't make it 6 months from now or until October because financial constraints and the world ends on the 21st, I will actually rebate any money. So if the show ends in July because we don't have enough members or whatever it is, I will rebate the money from now until July at 220%, but I won't do that until October 22nd. Well, I'll make PayPal do it. And it is also perhaps an apocalyptic day for the Republicans up in New York 26th District. You can help turn out the vote at callny26.com. We'll put that on the blog, callny26.com. You can make some calls to bring out the vote. This is, I generally don't put much weight into these special elections as a bellwether for anything, and I'm not necessarily now, but I do think that the narrative coming out of this will further marginalize Republicans who are now have decided to go all in support of the plan to destroy Medicare. And this will go a long way in not only marginalizing the Republicans in this position, it will also make it harder for Obama to cut a deal with the Republicans in a way that he doesn't have to on the debt ceiling. I will explain this more after our guest. But at a time where the Republican budget is so toxic and they've embraced it so hard, if Obama actually gives anything up substantially in this debt ceiling fight, know that this was his agenda, because he doesn't have to. This Medicare thing is a huge, huge winner for the Democrats and Obama if he so chooses come 2012. If he decides not to, he's not only screwing over the party, he is fulfilling a neoliberal agenda that has no political expediency. And I don't give him points for not choosing the political expediency at this point, because frankly, it's also right on policy. We got to take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Dennis Van Engelsdorp. He is the acting state apiarist in Pennsylvania. The B report came out yesterday, and he will tell us what it means, what the problem is with the bees, and why is most other Western industrialized countries doing something about this problem successfully, and we're not. Can you guess why? Can you guess why? I thought you could. We'll be right back. We are back on the Majority Report. It is a pleasure to welcome Dennis Van Engelsdorp. He is, and you're going to have to help me out with this, with the pronunciation of this. This is one of my hooks as a host, is not being able to pronounce certain words. Acting state apiarist for Pennsylvania?
Well, that's close. That is close. I'm now the senior extension associate, though, at Penn State University. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Well,
that just changed.
Congratulations.
Thanks.
All right. So before we get to the B report that came out yesterday, please give us, I know a little background. I don't know if our listeners do, but give us a little sense of the importance of honeybees and bees in general to our daily lives.
Sure. Honeybees are sort of, we consider them a keystone species in the agricultural ecosystem, and that's because they are essential in pollinating crops. So we estimate that about one in every three bites of food we eat are directly or indirectly pollinated by honeybees. So apple production, almond production, most of the seeds needed to grow vegetables all rely on insects and mostly honeybees for pollination.
And I presume to a certain extent also any type of grains that are fed to animals would rely on that as well.
Well, certainly most grains like corn and wheat are wind pollinated, so they don't need bees. However, things like alfalfa, in order to produce the seed for alfalfa, which is then laid, cut into hay and fed to our dairy cows, you need bees to pollinate alfalfa seed.
So, and over the past, I guess now 4 or 5 years, there's been a phenomenon that has been taking place called colony collapse. Tell us about that, how it was discovered, and what it means.
So, colony collapse disorder, we first we named that in early 2007, and that was the result of the fact that a Pennsylvania beekeeper had 3,000 colonies that were doing really well in November, and he brought them down to Florida, as he does every year, and he found a month later that 2,000 of the 3,000 colonies were completely abandoned. And then we discovered that this was happening in different parts of the country as well. Since then, we've tried to figure out what caused colony collapse disorder, and we haven't found a single cause. And so we think it's a whole bunch of different stress factors coming together, compromising the bee's immune system and causing them to die, basically, of the flu, or the bee equivalent of the flu.
Well, I was going to ask, now, when you say colony collapse, there's no, you don't see any dead bees, right? I mean, do we know where they go?
Well, actually, there's been a really interesting study out of North Carolina last year, and what we think happens is somehow the bees know that they're sick, and so they're sort of programmed to fly away from the hive to die in order to try to prevent infection of their nest mates. So we think it's a sort of a response to being very sick. And they'll fly as far as 2 miles away to die. So I think that we're thinking they die away from the hive.
Interesting. And we have this problem that was discovered 4 or 5 years ago. They are dying of a compromised immune system from a bunch of factors. What else do we know about it from there? I mean,
we also know that it's not just CCD killing our bees or colony collapse disorder. There's a lot of different things killing our bees, and in fact, last winter, the minority of the colonies that died from colony collapse disorder. There's a whole host of other things killing bees, and I think this has drawn our attention to the fact that there's just bees are under stress from a lot of different angles, and we need to address all those different angles.
And do we have a way of comparing how bees? Well, I guess this takes us to the latest bee report. What does it say relative to what's happened in the past 5 or 6 years? And what is the difference, let's say, today than it was 10, 15 years ago?
Right. So one of the questions we ask is what beekeepers would think is a normal or acceptable rate of loss. And that last year was about 13%, and over the last 3-5 years, it's between 12 and 17%, beekeepers are saying. However, over that last 5 years, we've lost 30% or better of our colonies every winter. Now, I do want to stress that it doesn't mean that in the summertime, at the end of August, that there are fewer colonies in the summer. In fact, there's probably a few more than 5 years ago. And that's because beekeepers are able to replace those dead colonies quickly by splitting a strong colony in half and adding a queen to that other half. But, of course, that's expensive. And so we're worried that the beekeepers who are losing sometimes 50% or more of their operations are going to go bankrupt in this process. And we need those beekeepers to pollinate the crops up and down the coast because they ship their bees up and down the coast. So a Pennsylvania beekeeper right now is moving out of apples in Pennsylvania, going to Maine to do blueberries. Then they'll do Massachusetts cranberries, come back to Pennsylvania to do pumpkins and cantaloupe, Florida for a while, and then almonds in California. And so all those other operations are in trouble if that beekeeper goes out of business.
Interesting. And do you have any data from prior to 5 years ago? I mean, if a beekeeper says now, like I'm expecting 13 to 17% to die off, is that a function of his or her knowledge of how much have been dying off in the past? Is it a function of just historically? I mean, do we have data prior to 5 or 6 years ago?
That's a really good question. Unfortunately, we don't have good winter loss data. That's something we just started collecting in response to this problem. We do know, though, that in the 1980s, some parasitic or vampire mites came into the country, and they really hurt bees.
Mm-hmm.
Before that, in all the bee books that were written, people would say if you lose less than 10%, you're doing fine. If it's more than 10%, there's something wrong. So So we know we're well above that 10% mark, but that is not hard fact. That's sort of anecdotal.
Do we have a sense of how bees are doing in this country versus in Europe, versus in the Southern Hemisphere, from around the world?
Well, and again, a great question. We're actually working with Europeans in order to sort of standardize our winter loss survey. They've been losing quite a few colonies. The Canadians as well have lost just the same number, if not a little bit less than we have in the States. So it looks like bees are in trouble internationally. And we're trying to, we actually have a conference in Chile in September where we're trying to do a international standard for calculating losses.
Now, I mean, in the UK, I saw a piece from Tom Philpott. He from, I think it was on grist.org. He said that the Brits were looking at, and maybe they have since banned, neonicotinoids. What are those?
Yeah.
And why has the UK acted upon this based upon USDA research, and we haven't? Hello?
Still there.
Yes, can you hear me?
Hello? Sorry, yes, I can.
I'm sorry.
I think I got the most of your question there. The question is about neonicotinoids and what they are and what their impact on bees are.
Yes.
So neonicotinoids are this special class of pesticides called systemic pesticides that is based on nicotine in tobacco plants. And the idea is that if you paint a little bit of this on a seed, the seed will absorb it, and then that toxin to insects will be right in that plant. The great thing about it is you only need a very little amount, and you don't have to spray your crops. You only apply it once. However, this product can sometimes get into the pollen and the nectar, and the bees can bring it home. So there's been a lot of concern that this may be the underlying cause for increased mortality. Certainly some lab experiments have demonstrated that it can be problematic to bees at very high doses. However, there still needs to be a lot more work done to prove that it's going to hurt bees in the field. And so I think that there's been a lot of pressure to ban this pesticide, but the feeling is that we have to make sure it's killing bees. Certainly, we have a lot more and growing evidence that other products, such as fungicides, which is very surprising, may be hurting bees as well. And so I think that the EPA is certainly looking very carefully at this and really trying to make evidence-based decisions rather than sort of decisions that may first sound right and make sense, but you need the data to back that up.
Now, has this stuff my understanding is that they've been banned or in Europe. Is that not right?
France has banned the product. I'm not sure that their losses have decreased since banning the product, and it's certainly a very controversial decision. And I know that there's a lot of work being done on these products to try to figure out what amount is safe and sort of the cost-benefit of pulling it from the market. And again, I think that there's growing sort of reports that are suggesting some other products might be hurting in combination bees as well. And so I think EPA is re-looking at how they evaluate products for bee safety.
And what about the USDA, Jeff Pettis? He's looked at this stuff as well, right? Are you familiar with that research?
Yeah, that was research that was done in the lab. So we were able to show that if you feed bees imidacloprid, which is a type of neonicotinoid, you can show evidence of decreased immune response. However, we haven't been able to show that in the field, which is, of course, what's really important.
Right.
How a handful of 20 bees reacts is very different than a whole colony of 40,000 individuals. And so I think that that's important to note, that you have to show evidence from the lab and also in the field. And a lot of people have been trying to show negative effects in the field, and it's not been easy to do.
Are honeybees in danger of in terms of just being existentially in terms of a species? I mean, you're talking about the economic impacts on beekeepers and the following impacts that it would be on our food supply. But as a species, are bees in a situation where they can survive without some type of human intervention, or without our taking some more aggressive steps in protecting them, perhaps from pesticides, et cetera?
Well, it's a great question. I think there's two answers to that. Honeybees specifically, certainly we don't think they're going to go extinct. We're sort of worried about the viability of that commercial beekeeping segment that we need to pollinate the crops in this country, that that remains viable. However, having said that, honeybees were introduced into the Americas with the colonialists, and so they're not native. There are over 4,000 species of native bees in America, and these tend to be solitary bees and very small, and they're very important too, and we actually don't know much about them. We're worried that about 3 or 4 species of bumblebees may be, have gone extinct, and so we know that pollination is best when you have both honeybees and the native bees working together, and so we need to do a lot more in order to encourage these populations of native bees.
And do we know if pesticides that are sprayed on crops that don't rely on bees for pollination, are they problematic to bees?
Well, there's a lot of work being done on that. Of course, you would never spray a crop that is flowering, so it would be sort of an indirect effect, so it could be from drift and so.
Mm-hmm.
So certainly, we're also, you know, we usually, like 3 years ago, we would have only been talking about insecticides, those pesticides designed to kill insects. We're now finding evidence that other things, like fungicides, may be having a negative effect on insects, on bees as well. And so there's growing research in these different realms.
So it could also be lawn care products. It could be stuff that isn't necessarily dealing at all with pests. It could be just stuff that is actually just theoretically supposed to help the plants.
Well, that's absolutely right. I mean, even indirectly, we know, for instance, herbicides. People put herbicides on their lawns to get rid of dandelion and clover. But dandelion and clover are great for bees. And so I think that something that people can really do is make sure that they have sort of pollinator gardens where they have plants that are blooming all year round for food source for these bees, not only honeybees, but these native bees, and also not putting herbicides on their lawn, letting these things we sometimes think of weeds but are really just flowering plants grow in their lawn, which act as a food source as well.
And a couple other questions I have, because we have a beekeeper who is a big fan of the show. Are beekeepers who try to organically manage their colonies or practice treatment-free beekeeping, are they doing better in the current crisis than beekeepers who use chemicals and antibiotics, or vice versa? Or is there do you have data that shows any difference?
Well, that's a great question. Our very preliminary survey did not show changes in mortality in the rate of colony death over the winter between organic and non-organic. We will say that the commercial beekeepers, the ones moving hives, lost fewer colonies than the rest of the population. However, we've just started a program, the Bee Informed Partnership, where that's exactly the questions we're asking. We're asking people, what management techniques did you use last year or did not use last year? And then we compare overwintering losses. And so we'll have very concrete answers for that in September when we finish analyzing that survey.
And where would people go to offer that information, assuming we have multiple beekeepers who listen to the show?
Right. We're going to be publicizing that at the beeinformed.org website, so B-E-E, informed.org.
And so for those of us who are not beekeepers, we can cut back on our use of herbicides, get rid of it, just let the dandelions grow, plant more pollinating flowers, I guess, in our gardens and on our stoops or whatnot. Anything else that we can do?
Sure. I think that one thing you can do is consider becoming a beekeeper. It's a fascinating and very enjoyable hobby. And so I would encourage everyone to at least open a hive once, and you'll know whether you're a beekeeper right away. You can also buy local honey and support your local beekeeping organizations and beekeepers. And then making sure that, as you said, having food for bees by planting a pollinator garden, and also some habitat. You can buy these bee boxes that are made of wood with different sized holes in them where solitary bees can nest. And so providing a space for bees in our environment, I think, is something we can all do.
All right. Now, I got one or two more questions, too. These are a little bit more personal. Carpenter bees, they're eating my house. Should I worry? Are they good bees?
Well, all bees pollinate crops, and so they're no different than those. They can become problematic, sure, so I would make sure that their populations didn't get too big.
Mm-hmm.
They're only going to be around for about a month.
Right.
So when they're done, you can sort of caulk those holes or screen those holes shut, and that will prevent the next generation from emerging next year.
Do they fight with wasps? Because I watch the wasps seem to be afraid of these carpenter bees. For people who don't know, carpenter bees are almost the size of a golf ball. They're huge. And that's a little bit of an exaggeration, but they seem to go after the wasps.
Well, what happens is that you'll see some of the smaller ones, they're the males, and they'll sort of hover around the place. They'll look for a female to come in so they can mount the female. So I think what's happening is when a wasp comes through, they think they're invading the territory, and they're trying to chase them away.
Ah, I see. And so, okay, yeah. Well, I didn't realize it was that much going on. That I got a 5-year-old daughter. I'm not sure I want her to see that.
I don't think you'll actually see the mounting, but you can see them certainly chase. If you throw a little pebble in the ground, you'll see that they'll chase that too.
Oh, interesting. All right. Well, thank you very much. So the next thing that I guess we should keeping an eye out for is come the fall when we get a better sense of how different types of beekeepers are doing.
Well, then we'll have an evaluation of the different management practices and which practices worked and which ones didn't in terms of reducing colony losses.
Interesting. And I have one final question. I'm sorry. Genetically modified crops, is there any evidence that this is in any way affecting the bee population?
No, and there's been lots of studies where they feed that pollen to the bees, and there is no evidence that that's detrimental. However, most of those genetically modified plants or crops have been developed so that they can spray a lot of herbicide on that crop without killing the crop. And, of course, that means they're killing, you know, some of the beneficial weeds that may be around that are a good pollen and food source for bees.
Interesting. All right. Well, thank you very much, Dennis Van Engelsdorp, the bee guy, if you don't
mind. Thank you.
All right. Well, we got to take a break, folks. We will be right back in just a moment. Interesting developments over at the SEC. There's one story that's a little bit disturbing. There's one story that I find quite funny, actually. We'll be right back after this break. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. So this guy, David Hilsenrath, in the Washington Post, has two stories back-to-back over the past 2 days. One outlining how the Justice Department and SEC investigations often rely on companies' internal probes is fascinating and disturbing. As the U.S. government steps up investigations at companies suspected paying bribes overseas and presumably any other infractions, law enforcement officials are leaving much of the detective work to the very corporations under suspicion. The Justice Department and Securities Exchange Commission often let the companies investigate themselves and then share the results. The strategy is especially common in cases of foreign corruption, but also extends to domestic investigations, issues as varied as healthcare fraud and shady accounting. The corporations, at the request of the government, hire teams of lawyers and accountants to interview employees, gather electronic records, and sift through documents. So what they do is the corporations hire so-called independent agencies, non-governmental agencies, companies, firms, full of former justice and SEC employees. It apparently is a very big business. an ongoing investigation for Diebold, which makes ATMs and questionable voting apparatus, has cost the firm $16 million. Avon has confirmed spending more than $130 million on these investigations. Now, law enforcement officials say they don't just take the company's word. Asked how the government knows the company's investigators are providing a complete and objective account, Lanny Brewer, head of the Justice Department's criminal division, says, well, that's why I have smart prosecutors to test and probe. What prevents the internal investigators from airbrushing the facts or, say, omitting evidence that might implicate the chief executive? You mean other than integrity? One former federal prosecutor replied, very little. Well, isn't that nice? Isn't that wonderful? I'm so glad these corporations are so full of integrity. I mean, we know how well that worked out with the whole rating agencies and those securities, right? What's to prevent Moody's or S&P from giving it a triple A rating when it's a piece of crap? Well, of course, their integrity.
Don't piss down my back and tell me it's raining.
And apparently, as part of Dodd-Frank, and this is the part of the story that I, another story that I really enjoy. As part of the Dodd-Frank financial regulation overhaul, the federal government plans to reward company insiders and other tipsters for blowing the whistle on corporate fraud. And the SEC is scheduled to vote on Wednesday on a far-reaching proposal to do just this by paying these private employees to join the fight. Now, as you may or may not know, the government already pays money to whistleblowers for exposing tax evasion fraud or Medicare scams, Pentagon procurement abuses. And so the SEC is going to vote on Wednesday to extend this type of program to financial fraud, to corporate fraud, and the corporations are really pissed about it. This is one of the funniest things I think I've read in a long time. Businesses say that before whistleblowers share information with the SEC, they should alert the company they are accusing and give the company a chance to address the alleged misconduct. That is wonderful. Some business groups say they are worried that the SEC could be overwhelmed with tips. And they say they want to ease the burden on regulators by screening the complaints. How wonderful. How nice. God. And they say business is just in it for the profit. Here you have these wonderful business leaders who are so concerned that if the SEC pays tipsters, pays whistleblowers money, that they could be overwhelmed, and businesses just want to help them out by sort of taking off some of that caseload. That's fantastic. You know, the mafia should have thought of this too. We don't want to overtax the police services. We want people to we want the cops to be able to be on the street and help old ladies cross the street. So what we're going to do is, if you get a guy who is an informant, have him come to us first. We'll see if it's worthy of your time. And if it's not, we'll just tell the guy to take a vacation somewhere. You won't hear from him again. This is fantastic. Companies are far better equipped to assess complaints in the context of their particular business and to separate the wheat from the chaff, said two major Wall Street groups, the financial services. This is hilarious. I mean, how embarrassed would you be to be the spokesperson for this and just get out there and just say, look, nobody knows better how to evaluate whether or not a whistleblower is telling the truth or knows what he's talking about, that we're up to wrongdoing, than we do. We're doing the wrongdoing. We should know. So basically what they're trying to do is they're trying to insert mitigating factors into this regulation that would pay whistleblowers. And it includes one measure that would prevent scorned husband or wives from cashing in on secrets. Husbands, really? Really? What they're afraid of is some of these douchebags who are going and doing blow on the nipples of strippers at bars are going to talk too much to their wives about their financial corner cutting. And then when it comes time for the divorce, they're going to get screwed. So we can't have that. You can't pay husbands or wives any money. And the Society of Corporate Secretaries and Governance Professionals, whose members play supporting roles for executive and board members, say whistleblowers should not be allowed to profit from information gained through the violation of any privileged information, such as spouses, or perhaps secretaries, or executive assistants, or anybody who would be in a position to actually blow the whistle. Number two, although the law prohibits companies from retaliating against employees for blowing the whistle, the corporate secretaries group asked the SEC to make it clear that companies could still fire whistleblowers for other reasons. Yes, granted, you went to the SEC and told them that we're involved in massive fraud, but we don't like the way you dress, and we can't fire you for blowing the whistle on us, but maybe you shouldn't be wearing those red-colored shoes. You're fired. Number three, a third proposed change would prohibit lawyers from representing whistleblowers for contingency fees. In other words, if we can get the trial lawyers out of the equation who represent whistleblowers and classes who may be defrauded by the information whistleblowers provide, then we can make it virtually impossible for them to get a lawyer to represent them. This is the same thing we saw the Supreme Court rule in a 5-4 split a couple of weeks ago on not allowing for arbitration claimants to form a class so that they could be represented by one attorney rather than 5,000 of them who are going after $30 be represented by 5,000 attorneys. This is just wonderful. Well, good luck with that, corporations. I'd be shocked if the SEC actually carries out this mandate from Dodd-Frank, but I hope they do. Meanwhile, in other news, Eric Schneiderman, Attorney General from New York, apparently JP Morgan Chase, UBS AG, and Deutsche Bank are being investigated by Eric Schneiderman. They are joining Goldman Sachs and Bank of America and Morgan Stanley being investigated. Just what they did with the TARP money and what claims they paid out and why during and after the economic crisis, or any information or documents related to litigation or settlements with the banks, according to a person with knowledge of the investigation. So that's good news. 50% of Americans couldn't come up with $2,000 if they had to in any type of medical emergency, if their car broke down, whatnot. This is according to a National Bureau of Economic Research survey. Participants were asked, would they be able to come up with $2,000 for an unexpected expense next month? 22.2 predicted they would be probably unable. 27.9 said they'd certainly be unable to foot the unplanned bill. Don't know how that measures up to the past, but I imagine it's significantly higher. Meanwhile, states shorten the duration for unemployment benefits. I touched on that in the post show yesterday. states have drained their unemployment insurance funds. Instead of raising taxes, they're just basically saying, good luck, or hopefully the federal government will pick up the tab. We know that's not the case. Republicans fought this tooth and nail. These we know that Orrin Hatch from Utah said that extensions of unemployment benefits are just going to encourage people not to work. They're going to be swimming in that sea of about $300 a week. Nothing like trying to raise a family on $300 a week. Good luck to you. And finally, before we go to our post show, you can IM me at Majority FM. UK public borrowing higher than expected in April. The figures were a surprising disappointment. The public finances have got off to a pretty bad start this year. This year in the UK, what does that remind me of? What's happening in the UK? Oh, I know, austerity measures. Meant to boost the confidence in the economy. Good luck with that economy boosting, or that confidence boosting, as your economy in the real world tanks because of cutbacks in government spending. Folks, speaking of cutbacks in non-governmental spending, don't make us force draconian austerity measures here at the Majority Report. We need your memberships. There's thousands, thousands upon thousands of you who listen to this show on a daily basis. You don't know what you're missing in the post show. But you do know what you'd be missing if the show went away. Any support you can give us, whether it's a one-time donation at Majority FM, or even better, a monthly membership. Yesterday, I was on Radigan's show. I'll talk about it in the post-show. But it was Tim Carney was there defending his $5,000 from the Koch brothers. Lee Fang was there talking about the money he gets from Soros. Everybody had a disclosure. My big disclosure, nobody pays me. Or rather, it's 800 members pay me. But we'll talk about that more. Oh, and you'll remember, I once took Matt Miller to task about his saying liberals should support the cuts of Social Security. I will tell you what he said to me after the program in the post show. What it may lead to in the future. And of course, you can support this show by buying your crap, your Amazon crap, through our link at Majority FM. Supporting justcoffee.coop, not just because you get a 10% discount with the coupon code Majority, not just because it supports me, but because it supports them. They got great coffee, great tea, great chocolate. And of course, you can always donate your Twitter account at donateyouraccount.com. I am firing up the IM machine. I am firing up the calls. 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920. We'll be right back in the post show after this.